Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. I thank you so much for being with us here as we bring you another conversation, another choice to add to all of the choices that we bring your way. As I've said many times, it's a program about choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we'll talk about when we're on and where and all of that. But right now, we're going to jump right into our conversation with our special guest. She is, among other things, she is an author, she's an historian, an editor, and she has a book, and it is entitled Going Over the Mountain, One Woman's Journey from Follower to Solo Hiker and Back. And Christine Woodside, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, I am one who absolutely loves to get out and walk. I live here in Santa Barbara, Southern California, or Central Coast, as they say. And though I live up in the mountains above Santa Barbara, where I work is the main street in the city. And I love getting out when I can get a break from the studio and going out and just taking a walk and stretching the legs and moving around and just, and meeting people too. I enjoy that as well. I have enjoyed hiking. When I was in Phoenix, we had a, now I'm going to call it by its original name. I don't mean to offend anybody, but it was the original name of this hill, if you will, or mountain that was in the Phoenix metropolitan area. It was called Squaw Peak. It's now been named for a Native American female and whose name I cannot recall, unfortunately. Needless to say, there were many others. There were there was a series of mountains called the North Mountains in the center of town as well. And I used to go there hiking a lot. I just loved being out there. I couldn't get that far away from the city because, well, it was right in the middle of town, but you kind of got away from the sound of the cars and all of that stuff. And that was, it wasn't bad. I remember one hike that some buddies of mine and I took back in the early 1990s. This is 1993. I started this men's group. There were only three of us. there was me, and I was the only married guy. There was an older gentleman who was a professor. He was divorced. And then there was a third fellow who owned a bar. And he was divorced. I think he was going through the melees. And we would go hiking in the hills around Santa Barbara. There's also some to the west and so forth. And one hike, we went up to a place called Seven Springs. We parked a car, or the truck, if you will, with one of the vehicles. And then the guy who owned the bar took us around to the head of the trail, which was, I mean, you had to go miles around. And we were going to do what we called a half-day hike. And we started at 10 a.m. Had no idea of the literalness of that. Because we weren't into the hike more than 15, 20 minutes. And the guy with the bar said, I really need to go back. Which meant we, the professor and I, were committed to hiking to where the truck was. And we ended up hiking in, I'm going to say, 1/4 moonlight as the sun went down. Now, I don't know if you've ever had this kind of an experience.
I have.
As we were walking in that 1/4 moonlight, we did not trip over anything. We went back the next weekend in the daylight. We were tripping over every frickin' rock in the place. It was unbelievable. So I attributed that first part in the moonlight to our intuition, our guides guiding us along one footstep at a time. But it was still a remarkable experience being out there in the wilderness. I'll call it the high desert. You know, there were trees and so forth and so on. I'm curious about, in general, and if you have a specific hike, because one thing that intrigues me about your story is your hiking, and again, correct me on the pronunciation of this.
Yeah.
The Appalachian Trail, or Appalachian, or Appalachian. I keep hearing different people calling it different things, but...
people... These days, more people are calling it the Appalachian Trail because that part of the part of the world known as Appalachia, sort of West Virginia, Virginia area, that's really how people say it down there. And so out of respect, I am from, you know, I grew up in New Jersey. I live in Connecticut. I'm a Northeasterner, and I still say Appalachian Trail, referring to the entire Appalachian mountain chain. It's not wrong to say it either way. It's more a question of where you are and, you know, the local custom at this point.
Well, tell us a little bit about your experiences, and in particular, as I was alluding to, I guess I could put it in this context, maybe like more of a supernatural experience or spiritual or metaphysical experience, a non-material world experience as you would travel. And maybe it was a particular trail. Maybe it was a particular part of the country. Sedona, I don't know if you've ever hiked in the area there where they say there are all these just different energy vortices and so on and so forth. People have different experiences. They'll go to meditate in these different areas of the world, for that matter. What was from that standpoint, maybe the most profound journey that you were on?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it. I think that for me, I've never been to Sedona, although I know about Sedona and what people say about the energy they believe is there. I think what my experience has been that when I'm out for several days, you know, get to about day three, and you begin to change your sense of time. Time slows down. Everything slows down. And it seems expansive. And you know how when we're normally in you know, just normal life with appointments and places to go and things to do, and the ability to get places quickly, usually many of us at home with transportation and cars and trains and things. When I'm out in the backcountry, I feel like every day is longer. And then that is transformative. A lot of times the transformation doesn't become evident until really you're almost done with it, from my experience. And it's sort of what I bring out into regular life from the woods with me. Or there'll be a moment several days in where I'll be sort of sitting looking at something, and I'll think, wow. I don't even know what day it is. I don't even know what it sounds really crazy, but I don't even know what my name is. And there was one solo hike I took of 4 days around the White Mountains on a series of trails that circles around the Pemigewasset Wilderness. Lots of people like to do that loop in one day. You know, people who like to run, it's 30 plus miles. I like to stretch it out and do it with a backpack and tent, you know, my tent, and really, really spread it out. And I believe this was the morning of my last day before I was going to hike out to the road. And I woke up super early because who knows what time it is. The sun came up. I woke up. I was doing a weird thing on that trip where I wasn't doing a lot of food prep. I had food that was just easy to eat. I'll never do that again, by the way. I like eating food. So I had all this time, you know, I like ate my horrible bread and my cranberries and my tea. And I was just sort of standing on the tent platform at Liberty Spring tent site and looking up into the trees. And suddenly my father was with me. You know, my father had died many years before. And it just felt as if he were right there with me. I knew what he was thinking. I could feel his soul, you know, sort of visited me. So that was probably one of the more profound moments for me.
I haven't had that yet with my father. He passed away March of 23. And I get impressions from him, but I'm actually excited about the prospects because I'm very much wanting to, I remember my mother asking me, I mean, I've been doing this program for over 15 years, but I've been on my search since I was 17. My metaphysical primer is Autobiography of a Yogi. And she asked me once if I had ever had any supernatural experiences. You know, I'll lay on two or three other terms, you know, spiritual, metaphysical, etc., esoteric. And I said, well, no, not that I'm aware of, because if I have, they've sort of been presented as just kind of like normal occurrences in the material world, which from my perspective is just fine, because even though I know myself well enough that, yes, I have a pretty good size ego. That's one of the reasons I'm doing this, because I enjoy the conversations and so forth.
Right.
But I also, there are times when I almost want to become invisible and sort of disappear. It doesn't happen a lot, but it comes and goes. And I wonder sometimes for you, if when you're hiking and you've been, first of all, how many different, if you have indeed left the States, have you been hiking in other countries? How many other countries, or here in the States, how many parts of the country have you hiked in? Have you, if you've kept records in that regard, or did you just, hey, I've been to 5 dozen places, I don't remember them all, but did you keep a journal in that regard, and et cetera, et cetera? Let's start there with that aspect of it.
Sure. Well, I have kept a journal forever. I don't know if you can see them in my office. You see those three shelves?
Oh,
those
my.
Are my journals.
And
yeah.
I thought I had a lot of journals since I was 21.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I have a lot. I am really mostly a Northeast hiker, but so I've hiked thousands of miles in the East, in the Eastern U.S. Mm-hmm. I did the whole Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine. I've done the long trail in Vermont, but the part of that is the AT, but there was a whole other section of, about 150 miles, 200 miles that we had to finish on that. Mm-hmm. I've hiked in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. I've done all the large peaks there. I've done multiple backpacking trips there. I've hiked, as I mentioned in the book, a bunch of trips down with my daughters to Tennessee, Virginia, North Carolina. And in terms of the rest of the world, I have hiked, we went to Banff National Park in Canada, you know, Western Canada, many years ago with our children. We hiked 14, you know, miles in and out to Egypt Lake there, which was incredible. I've done day hiking in, well, let's see, I did a little backpacking in Colorado many years ago. I've done some day hiking in Arizona near Tucson and near Phoenix, although I didn't do any of the places you mentioned, but I've Camelback.
I've hiked Camelback too, yeah.
That I did in Phoenix. And my daughter lives in, our daughter lives in Los Angeles now, and so we do day hiking around there. She takes us to all these places there, but no, I've never done any backpacking. So I really am an Easterner, and I've been, I've been to the UK several times, but I've only really done any hiking there once or twice, and nothing overnight. So I'm, my landscape is really New England at this point.
Is there, let me rephrase that. Are there hikes that you haven't taken that you would really like to? Like, oh, I don't know. Do you want to hike Mount Everest, Kilimanjaro? Do you want to go up Mount Shasta, Mount Hood, et cetera, et cetera? Are there places that you haven't been you'd really like to go? Or is that what it's about for you? It's more, I just want to experience the world.
Well, one second. I just sure. want to put my thing back in
here. We're talking here today here on Tell Me Your Story with Christine Woodside. And of course, just a quick reminder that the title of her book, we hope you'll pick up a copy, folks. And it happens to be Going Over the Mountain. It is one woman's journey from follower to solo hiker and back. Website is chriswoodside.com. Will be linked to that website. So what about that in terms of the places that you haven't been that you'd like to go?
Well, I'm not really a bucket list kind of person. I don't think in that way. But maybe it's because all the things that I truly yearned to do, I have done. We had talked, my husband and I have talked sometimes about doing the Pacific Crest Trail or the Continental Divide Trail. And I'm not sure whether that's calling me at this point or not. I definitely will continue backpacking until I can no longer walk. There's no question about that. I'm going to the White Mountains for 3 days this July. We know I'm going to do that. We're going to do that with a friend. So it's interesting. So you asked about Mount Everest.
Yeah.
Life is a funny thing. You know, it's sort of what do you encounter when it would have been the right moment in time? I am not a technical climber, you know, so I don't have training with ropes and those sorts of climbs. I'm aware that Everest now is such a fixed route that you wouldn't have to do that. But there are two big reasons why I wouldn't want to do Everest. Well, why I almost feel like it would be a bad idea. And one reason is I don't have those skills, and I don't want to pay someone to haul me up. You know, I would want to do it myself with others, you know, but if I were going to do it. And the other is I didn't know about Everest when I was at the age where making that a goal might have been reasonable. I just didn't really know or think. And what I would want to do, I think, would be to perhaps trek in close enough so that I could see the immensity of Everest.
Yeah.
Everest, there's even more than two reasons. But, you know, Everest has been so visited. It is the mountain. I almost feel like we need to give it a rest. The humanity has overrun this amazing peak. And I wouldn't want to be part of the problem. And, you know, I'm to the point in my life where do I want to go and try to adjust to the altitude just to be near that and go through the cost and trouble and use of fossil fuels to get somewhere just so I can see something? And the answer is no, you know, no, I don't. So I think that I'm carrying around with me a feeling that I want to respect the land.
Yeah.
And know it really well. And if you've ever heard of Nan Shepherd, who wrote a book called The Living Mountain about the Cairngorms in Scotland, Nan Shepherd lived in Scotland her whole life, and she knew this one mountain range super well, the Cairngorms. And I've lived in the Northeast my whole life, and my mountain range is the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And I think maybe that is a beautiful thing, you know, to know this one range super well. But I'm not going to say I won't go a lot of other places. So what do I dream of? I would like to go to Scotland and do some backpacking there. I've been to Scotland a few times, so I'd like to go and really, really do some hiking there. I would really love to do more hiking in Canada. Those are the two that are calling to me at the moment.
Yeah, well, Canada's a lot closer, of course, than Scotland. But I would love to do some hiking in Ireland. I've been there twice, but it's been 20 years since I've been there. I just love the country. I love the hills and all of that stuff. And I know that Scotland and England and Wales and so forth are similar in terrain. So it, you know, would be very, and I would prefer, I'd personally prefer the cooler weather. Born and raised in Phoenix, had enough of the heat. And that's one of the reasons I'm here in Santa Barbara and on the Central Coast. It's much more pleasant. And I have to say that as you were sharing your stories there of the different places that you have been, the memories came flooding back of my hikes with these three guys. Two are very impactful in that Three of them actually. One was we were hiking literally, and these were the mountains to the west of Phoenix, literally in a downpour. I mean, it was raining like crazy. And when we crossed this one stream, wasn't a problem. We could step on the stones and walk across. And then we went up this hill to the top of a waterfall. We actually walked across this waterfall. As we're heading back and we're crossing over that same stream, it was now thigh high.
Yep.
But
I was gonna ask, so now it was impassable.
oh no, we went through it
Sucks.
thigh high. We walked on through it because we were already soaking wet. How much wetter can you get than soaking wet? So it didn't bother us at all. Then we were in those same mountains about 3, 4 weeks later. And of course, in Arizona, the saguaro cactus is protected. You cannot cut them down. However, if they have fallen, if you will, they're fair game. Just to summarize, I have a hiking stick that I carved out of a giant saguaro cactus rib.
Wow.
The one of the other hikes that we took, aside from the one in Seven Springs, where we were hiking from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., we went out to the Superstition Mountains, and it had just rained a week or so earlier. And what we would do is, and by the way, I was the guy that carried the backpack. I was the lucky one. And
Well, you had one backpack between the three of you? Oh,
because
wow.
we tried to travel as light as possible. They tried to travel as light as possible.
They had a great deal.
Oh yeah, they did, didn't they? I was there, I guess I was their Sherpa of sorts.
Yes.
So what we would do when we wanted a fire, we would dig a hole, and then we would surround the hole with rocks. And then we would try to find something that we could put on to, over the edge of the pit to cook our hot dogs or whatever it was we had. So we did this in the Superstition Mountains. We started up, we dug the hole, we started a fire, we put the rocks around it, not even thinking that we were in imminent danger. Because as the rocks heated, there was water inside the rocks. And it would expand, and the rocks, some of them started to explode.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, it wasn't a huge explosion like a hand grenade, but it was enough to wake us up in a big way. But I have to say that
Yeah.
those hikes were just, they were, I even went on a hike with one of the gentlemen. It was he and I, the older professor, on an Easter Sunday. And it was at a place called Papago Park. In Phoenix, in the central area of Phoenix. And I have pictures of some of these hikes as well. But it was like a dream when we would go hiking. And we'd go in as far as we felt comfortable going in, and then we turn around and we go back. And
Yeah.
I'm wondering, because you talked about the 3 day effect, if you will. At the as
Yeah.
after the third day, you lose sense of, and I have not been on long hikes. I usually just day hikes.
Yeah.
When you and I'm curious as first of all, how long have you been married? Or let me rephrase that. How long have you been with your husband now?
Oh goodness. Well, I met him in 1983.
Wow, wonderful.
Yeah, I was very young when I met him. I was still 23 years old, and we have been married since 1985.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious on a percentage basis rather than numerical, how many of the hikes that you have taken since have been solo?
A percentage basis, my hike solo, oh, probably 20%, maybe.
And do you prefer them, or you just like them when you take them, or do you prefer group hikes like you and your partner, your husband, and as you just said, you and your husband and another person are going on a hike here shortly. Are there particular hikes, or does it just really depend upon where you're going and so forth?
Well, I think for me, it's been an evolution, and I've had periods of my life where I really preferred being alone, and I had to evolve into that. you know, my story began with not knowing anything about mountains, following people, needing to be taught. And then my Appalachian Trail thru-hike was a learning experience and a transformation where, you know, I realized it doesn't really matter what you do in life or even what your name is. It's really just you're a pilgrim and, you know, how do you treat the other pilgrims? So, but I had to learn all that. Hiking partners are very special people. It's like picking a best friend in order to be able to be in that intense an experience, even for 3 or 4 hours or so. It really helps to have someone I trust. So I've had some wonderful, wonderful hiking partners who I write about. And then I've had partnerships that sort of ran their course and that was fine. You know, things were perfect for a while. We were all at the place in our lives where we needed to be doing that. And we needed to be doing that with each other. And then for whatever reason, we began to diverge in different directions. And I hit that point. I guess I was partway through my 40s or, you know, late 40s, early 50s. And I'd been hiking with other people a lot and realized the importance of doing it with the right people. And then I knew it was time to go alone. We had had a particularly difficult trip with a very dear friend and his very dear daughter who decided, you know, she just had a really, really rough trip in Maine with us and didn't want to do it anymore. And I came home so exhausted from that trip that I thought, I began to feel that I was sort of relying on others to give me something I needed. And then that was the moment I knew I needed to give it to myself so that I took the pressure off others in a sense. You asked me in a general sense, what do I prefer? I think kind of depends. But I do love going alone. I love my own company and I love the company of others who love me and I love them. I will not put up with situations where I don't trust or they don't trust me, those kinds of situations. I don't go hiking with large groups of people who I don't know, for example, which is a handy way for people to learn how to hike. If they've never hiked before, you sign up for something and there's a leader, you know, and those things can be great, but I don't do that anymore. Because that just doesn't serve me. So I like the fact that I know I could get myself out of the woods as long as I'm, you know, not injured. Sorry about the siren there.
No, I don't hear a thing, but go ahead.
Okay. My office is next to a very sweet little fire department.
Hey, as long as they're there to take care of you, if there's ever
a problem, are. Yeah.
Then thumbs up to them. The first responders, thank you for being there. Your opinion is the difference between a hike and a climb? Because I know that, for example, Squaw Peak, as I mentioned before, which I grew up as a kid going to and bicycling to and hiking, there are stretches that back then there was a little bit of climbing. It wasn't horrendous. You didn't need ropes and things of that nature, but you still had to go up, you know, and the elevation rose and so on and so forth until you reached the peak, the very top. For you, what sets one hike apart from another where you would say, yes, I'm going to do this one, as opposed to no, that is like you were talking about Mount Everest. That's outside my skill set. I'm not going on that one. Thank you very much.
Well, I think it's pretty, very obvious to me. I wouldn't go, you know, I won't try to go up a cliff that I can't keep my boots on the ground more or less and scramble up.
Right.
I've been in, you know, there are some mountains in the Adirondacks particularly where you are really kind of holding on, you know, to the cliff and getting your way up. And those are called trails. And they're very steep. Particularly Yeah, I mean, Mount Basin, Mount Saddleback in the Adirondacks, and I actually write about them in my book. And then in Vermont, you get up on Mount Mansfield, which is the highest peak in the state of Vermont. And there's a section there where you're going up over something called, I think they call it the nose, because Mansfield sort of looks like a reclining person's head. You're into that kind of thing. So, you know, it's a scramble, and there's a moment where you think, hey, you know, but the other than those, you know, and the White Mountains too, the Carter Range of the White Mountains, the cliffs of North Carter are very steep, and you do have to scramble up, and I've done those with loaded packs. But I don't go on, technical climbing routes. And in any mountain range, you'll find routes that go up the face, you know, up the front face that people use ropes to get up. And I just don't have those skills. I haven't learned how to do that. And I'm happy to let other people do that.
Absolutely. No free climbing here either. I have no interest in doing that. I do have to say that when I hear these stories, these news reports of an individual who has been hiking, climbing, free climbing, whatever it is that it's high risk, if you will, for you and I would be very high risk.
Right, like Alex Honnold.
And they end up dying. And they usually and usually one of the statements that is made by the commentator, the documentarian, the reporter is, well, they died doing what they loved. And I say, no, they didn't, because they fell 200, 400, 600 feet to their death. Falling was not what they enjoyed doing. And that's semantics granted, but I have to, forgive. I don't mean disrespect to those who passed, but come on, they did not die doing what they loved. They were doing what they loved until they fell. And unfortunately, their life came to an end. And we hope that never happens to folks. Now, I did have an experience on Squaw Peak. I was hiking up that with the three buddies, right? I had the backpack once again. We get to the summit, and there's not a lot of room at the top of this peak. I mean, maybe three or four people can stand on the top, right? And we all get up there, and I'm standing upright, and all of the sudden I start feeling myself going backward. And I had just seen a documentary of a local gentleman by the name of Preston Westmoreland, and he's done a lot of stuff in Phoenix and Arizona on the hiking and so forth in the wilderness. And one of the things that he talked about, when you're hiking and you feel like you're about to, fall over one way or the other, get down, squat down, and lower your center of gravity. I remembered that, and immediately I went down, squatted down, and I think literally saved my life. Nobody reached out to grab me either, but
They didn't
so
have time to
I
react.
did know. I immediately squatted down and got my balance back and was okay. We're talking here with Chris Woodside. The book, once again, Going Over the Mountain. It is one woman's journey from follower to solo hiker and back. I want to ask you, first of all, what was your upbringing philosophically?
Philosophically. What an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah, I it's more general than saying, so how were you raised religiously? Because not everybody conceives of how they were raised, in a metaphysical or spiritual context, sees that, because again, a lot of the studies are, well, X number of the population says they're spiritual and not religious, that kind of thing. So that's why I use the word philosophical.
Well, I will answer that question. And before I do, I want to very quickly address the question of people who die doing what they love, doing what they, quote, loved. That has made me angry over the years. But I actually think it's important to remember that all of us who seek things that give us meaning are conducting lives of calculated risk. Every time I go out in my car, it's a calculated risk. It's a decision I've made to drive in my car in rush hour traffic. So I think, and someone like Alex Honnold, who's just an absolute master climber and does things that curl my teeth, you know, just frightening. But, you know, he's very much alive. He has a wife and two little babies now, and he has a lot to live for. And when I look at him on a cliff, I ask myself what goes through his head. But here's a man who knows what he's doing. So I guess it's important for all of us to respect others for what they choose to do, unless they're being reckless and hurting other people in the process. Mm-hmm. And my heart does go out to the family members of people who do risky pursuits, because they do need to make sense of it if someone dies doing it. And, you know, I had a big birthday recently, and I went up to the White Mountains in March, still winter. And I was going to climb Mount Washington, the highest peak, but it was too dangerous that day when I was going to do it. And I'm not normally a winter climber, you know, mm-hmm. so I hired a guide for the first time in my life. And I climbed a smaller mountain in the Whites, still a 4,000 footer, Mount Pierce. Mm-hmm. My family thought I was nuts. And you know, my sister lovingly said to me, you know, why did you do that? She said, on my birthday, I might go, you know, do something like go to a place where I would be very comfortable in a spa or something like that. And I get that. So anyway, I just wanted to comment on that a little bit.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
It's a complicated issue. And I definitely know what you're saying. And there's so many, we could all talk about that for hours.
Yeah.
So you asked about my upbringing. I was brought up by loving parents who grew up during the Depression. My mother was born in 1929. My father was born in 1923. My father came from a lower middle class slash lower class background. His ancestors had been farmers for years in southern New Jersey. His father became a union worker in factories. My father then found himself going to college. He was able to go to college because he was a champion soccer player. So the point here is dad was pinching himself all through his adult life. He made a career in banking. He had, you know, my mother, he married my mother, and they had five. I'm one of five children. I'm the fourth of five children. He moved us to Princeton, New Jersey, which he just thought of as, you know, an unreachable place when he was growing up. He never thought anyone could live in a place like Princeton, New Jersey. And he was, you know, kind of self-made, but he also struggled with money later in life. And, you know, it wasn't easy. It wasn't always easy for him. And so that was the context of my upbringing. My parents, you know, we were churchgoers. We went to the Episcopal Church. There was a foundation of love. It was not overbearing in our daily lives. We were given lots of freedom to think about that. It was definitely presented to us as this is, you do this by your own choice. However, your own choice, you know, we felt free, but the women in my family, particularly in my mother and grandmother's generations, did not have much freedom. My grandmother was forbidden to drive a car. I actually write about that a little in my book.
Wow.
My mother and her two sisters did not learn to drive until they left home because their father would not let them. And my mother learned as a married woman. And she also didn't have a career until I was already a teenager, and my father did not want her to have a career. And I watched all that growing up, watch. And I really wanted a little more agency, you know? So I think that was, I kind of entered the world, you know, on a horse, you know, just metaphorically. I'm like, world, here I come. I'm going to figure it out. And the mountains ended up being one of the places where I could figure it out.
You know, that's interesting. And I was going to say something else until you said that about the mountains, because one of the songs by John Denver, he talks about his friends in the mountains. And then the very next line is, my friends are the mountains.
Hmm.
I mean, he lived in the Rockies. He lived in Colorado and so forth. I know that everybody has their preference for where they want to live. I have wanted to live by the ocean not just because I was raised in the desert. I never understood that. I always made that comment. Whose brilliant idea was it to set up a town in the middle of the hot desert? Come on, people. But I never expected to be here in Santa Barbara. I didn't know where I was going to wind up as far as close to the ocean. And here I am living in one of the most, I guess you could say, affluent and expensive places to live, not only in the country, maybe in the world. And yet here I am. Now, I'm not a wealthy man by monetary standards. Yet at the same time, I was going to ask you along those lines, because I've got another line of questioning here, so to speak, Your Honor, if I may. For you today, are you wealthy? Are you successful? And what's the difference for you between those two, especially in light of this wonderful work going over the mountain that you bring us today?
I am not wealthy. I am decidedly middle class. I do have a college degree and a master's degree, so I feel very successful in that way because these were things that meant a lot to me. There were no women in my family who had done those things. I also feel successful in that I've been able to contribute half and more, some often more than half of the income to my household most of my adult life. My husband was a teacher most of his career. He's now working in manufacturing, building heaters that wrap around equipment. I don't even understand what he does. And I have been a journalist most of my life and am also teaching at this point a little bit, teaching at the college level some and editing a journal about mountains. And so these are all things I really wanted to do. So in that sense, I feel very lucky and very, very happy. Money is a constant worry for me. I always worry about money. If money is something I don't understand entirely, it seems to take on a life of its own. and so that is a big stressor for us. But all that said, we have been fine. I mean, we've paid the mortgage every month for many, many years. And I have an office that I've been renting for 22 years in this building here in Chester, Connecticut. And so, you know, I guess it kind of harkens back a little bit to my upbringing when my parents did tell us, you know, you should do what makes you happy. You know, you really need to love your work. My father would say that to me. And I believe that firmly. And I feel very lucky that I can do that.
You must be related to me somehow. I don't know how, because you and I share the same, I'll call it perspective, as you've just described. And my father said to me many, many years ago, Richard, find something that you love doing because you're going to be doing it for a long time. Don't get stuck like me. Now, I always add the addendum. My father didn't stay stuck, as he put it. He went back to college, got his computer programming degree, and moved on to doing that. But now what's funny is that he told me that after I got into this business at the age of 19. I can't remember how old I was when he told me that. It might have been in my 20s or 30s. I'm 64 now. Well, I'll be 64 in a month. But it's like, I don't want to say I fell into it, but I've always felt like I've been in the right place at the right time. And the reason I ask you about your upbringing and your philosophy and so forth is because I wonder if maybe from your perspective, because obviously you say, all right, middle class, doing well, mortgage paid and so on and so forth. And yet mentally, I've struggled with, as I have struggled with, the whole concept of money. It's one of those things that I'm 30 years younger than my father would have been had he lived. He was 91 when he passed. and would have been 62 years married that June with to my mother. She's still alive. She'll be 90 this year.
Wow.
And one of the things I think that I have gleaned, I'll share this with you real quickly, is that family, community, I'll even broaden it to that because that includes family, is so danged important. It's vital. And I'm not saying that because you're going to need them. If you need help, you're going to need to call on them. No, it's not how it works. It's you are there for each other. I have a right. best friend who passed away after knowing him for 53 years. I still think about
hard.
It. Yeah. And yet he called me once, maybe 10 or 15 years earlier. And he was living in his car, homeless, in spite of the fact that over the years he'd had wonderful jobs. He even had a house and on and on and on. Now he's in his car and he's calling me for help. And I know that he was probably wanting money. And I wish I could have sent him something, but I didn't have it then. All I could offer him was advice. I said, you and I were born and raised in Phoenix. You have a network of close friends there. Go to one of them and say, look, could I stay on your couch or set up your garage and so forth to where I could stay there for a little while until I get myself back on my feet? He found someone who did just that. And he did get back up on his feet. And he got jobs again and so on and so forth. So community is so important. Talk to us a little bit about your perspective on what's important in what we've just been discussing. What's more important than, sadly, the worries that we have over, over our financial situations. And yet you and I, we're still here. We're having this conversation. It's a wonderful thing.
So your question is, what is more important than what? I'm
well,
not sure I got the
what's
question.
What is your perspective in that regards to a community and that network, setting up that kind of a network, staying connected with family so that you are there to be lifted up and to lift up them up as well?
Well, human beings we're social creatures, and it's just impossible for us to live without each other. So, I talk about loving to go off alone, and I like to go off alone so that when I come back, I am a good partner, mother, sister, friend to people. Family is vital, and not all family is blood relative family. Some of it is family we have acquired, that I have acquired as I go through my life. But I'm very careful about spending time with people who are the right people for me, and I'm the right people for them. That's one thing I've sort of learned. I think when I was much, much younger, I tended to sort of traipse through life. And if someone invited me somewhere, I would just go. And, I felt like I was encountering all kinds of people all the time. And it was hard to sort out who mattered. And now I don't waste any time on that anymore. I've been able to, I can identify, I understand my gut better than I used to about that. We just don't have time. I don't have time on this planet to spend time with the wrong people, and the wrong people spending time with me. We all have to find the right people so that we can be loving people. But it basically is, it's what being human is all about. It's, I was hungry. Did you feed me? I was lonely. Did you help me? Did you love me? That's the foundation of my spiritual and personal approach to life.
Great quote here. And you also use your discernment. And I want to lead into, especially in regards to your hikes, but just in your life in general, when you're not out there hiking, in terms of that, your internal life, we promote on this program, people spending time during this, the decade of perfect vision, the 2020s, going within to that quiet, peaceful, calm, still place and listening to that still small voice. I would venture on those solo hikes, and it's a wonderful thing you say, that you are very comfortable being with yourself. There are some people who, if they could, they'd get away from themselves, which is, you need to get closer to yourself as you do. But talk to us a little bit about that aspect of maybe the hikes, but also just your life in general when you're not hiking, and that aspect of your intuition in guiding you.
Of learning to be alone, you mean?
Well, not just being alone, but just listening to that still small voice as you as you go through your day to day.
Right. I think that there are physical symptoms that I suffer if I'm doing something that is not right for me. I will feel ill, you know, in certain ways. So I've learned to listen to that. And, you know, the still small voice, which is a wonderful quotation, it's actually from something biblical, and I think that's the King James translation. It's a beautiful phrase. It's a beautiful phrase about listening to the deep knowledge, you know, that comes from within. You know, the way to listen to that is to listen to it, and it takes practice to listen to it. And I suppose one reason that I found going alone in the mountains so helpful, and also I have this office I rent, it's 87 square foot office where I come and there's nobody else here. There's a very nice community in the building here. And, you know, I love them all, the landlord and some of the other people. But I come here alone. I grew up in a big family. You know, you could hardly get a word in edgewise. It was lovely. It was fun. It was hilarious. Three older brothers throwing balls all the time. I mean, you know, and I still feel that urge to, especially being female in the time in which I grew up, a lot of times women were sort of supposed to be seen and not heard. And I needed to figure out how to know what I really wanted, what I really believed, what I would say when someone challenged me. I don't think so well on my feet unless I've been able to have long periods of time just by myself to let the proper thoughts come in. And that's an occupational thing too, being a writer by trade. In order to write, I do need to have these times when I'm alone, and I do it in the mountains, and I also do it, I rent a house periodically and go there. And you know, a lot of this is about facing my own mortality, and not being afraid of that. And then I realize what makes life worth living, and not wasting my time on things that I'm not suited to do, I'm not good at doing, that I could trust others in my community to do. Sorting all that out, I need to be alone to do that.
I know that we all need that alone time, that downtime, so to speak, from the rest of the world. I get counseled on that regularly from members of my community. That, yeah, you've got all this other stuff going on, but you need to take care of you. The hikes take care of you.
They do. They completely renew me. I'm rejuvenated by them. And often I'm rejuvenated more if I've gone through something a little difficult on the hike where I've had to, you know, make sure I don't get too cold, or I get caught in some bad weather, or I get a little lost for a while and have to find my way. And that's true with other people as well. Then, you know, it's sort of like, whoa, like my whole brain just got turned around. You know, and there are these moments where that happens. I remember standing in a hailstorm on this trail way up in northern New Hampshire, almost in Canada, called the Cohos Trail. And we're my dear friend Martha, my husband Nat, and I had been hiking in this very hot weather all day a couple years ago. And then we jumped in a reservoir that was okay to jump in. We were allowed to. And then we're like hiking again, and suddenly everything changed and the clouds roll in and these giant hailstones started coming down, landing on the pine forest floor. And I'm looking at the contrast of the hailstones to the dark pine needles. And I was just, you know, it was like, who am I? What am I doing? Wow. And then you come out of that and everything is clearer, you know, about what matters, I guess. I'm sort of rambling a bit about that, but.
Not at all. Not at
yeah.
all. I think that's something that we all need to do. Where I live up in the mountains above Santa Barbara, the San Ynez Mountains, it's up Highway 154. They call it San Marcos Pass. And we're at the summit. We're at the summit where I wish we had an ocean view rather than a valley view, but it's okay. I mean, when it rains, and we've had some really heavy rains the last couple of years during the winter times, right? And I'll get calls or texts from people saying, are you guys okay? Any flooding and so forth? Well, we're kind of not sitting on top of a hill, but we're not in any danger in that regard because all the water is running down around us,
yeah.
You know, not
yeah.
through the house, you know, that kind of thing. And we've had some wonderful experiences. Like, what was it? The year my father passed away. Matter of fact, it was even the month prior. We got snow. I experienced for the first time in my life a snowfall. We were actually outside in it as it was coming down. I've got videos that I have of it and pictures galore. And it was just glorious. And then, of course, March 1st, when my father passed, the snow was still on the ground. And I thought, at least from my perspective, with all of this whiteness on the ground, you know, he picked a great day to go, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and
that was the first time you'd ever seen snow.
No, not seen snow. Actually been in a snowfall. In other words, I've been in snow before. I've been up to my hips in it. I got a little deep. We went up to Yosemite just outside of Yosemite. We had our travel trailer and then we went up the hill and there was snow on the ground. And I actually sort of dragged our dog into the snow. He was not happy. I've been in snow. I've seen snow. We've had snowfalls before, but very, very light where it's just a dusting. But this was where we had a couple of inches on the ground and I was out in it with my head up and a cap on because it would have been cold on this dome. But it was marvelous. And it was, like I said,
it's amazing.
Last year perfect. It was perfect in regards to knowing that, I mean, because my father, he was on his way out and we all knew it. And it was from my perspective, my family, the rest of the family lives in Arizona, in Phoenix. But it was glorious from that standpoint. Now you say you're not a winter hiker, but have you actually hiked in rather adverse conditions, or do you actually do your utmost to stay away from those kinds of conditions altogether?
I've certainly done a lot of day hiking in winter conditions. I've snowshoed, for example. I've done some cross-country skiing. But I don't seek out the mountains in these winter conditions because it's a different kind of experience.
Yeah.
You have to be outfitted differently. You need to think differently. And as I learned from my wonderful guide who I hired, took me up Mount Pierce, even stopping to eat your body reacts differently in 18 degrees. Stopping to eat, it's going to make you colder because body starts trying to digest and all your blood goes, you know, all this stuff. So the answer is I stick to a closer to sea level. But all year round I'm hiking on trails. Where I live in Connecticut, we're on basically on the banks of the Connecticut River. So we're almost at sea level here in the lower Connecticut River Valley. And you know, I hike around here all the time. There's 800 miles of trails in Connecticut, and I am a volunteer trail maintainer. And so I'm on trails a lot, but so in snow often. But I just, I'm not interested in post-holing up to my waist in snow. I'm willing to let the mountain recover a little from the winter and melt out, and then I'll go and say, thank you, mountain, you know.
There's one other aspect of your life and so forth that's listed here. You're an historian. What aspect of history do you deal with?
Well, I went and got my master's degree about 5 years ago after many years of being a journalist. I'm very interested in the late 18th The late 1800s and the 20th century, up until about 1950. I'm interested in the pioneer times and then the way the industrial America changed daily life. Those are the things that fascinate me. I wrote a book about the Little House on the Prairie author, Laura Ingalls Wilder, and her daughter. And if you've ever heard of Little House on the Prairie, it was also made into a television show. It's kind of she's sort of the iconic prairie figure. And my book explored her daughter, who was the one of the founders of the libertarian political movement, and how they put libertarian ideas into those books. And so that's my interest. And right now I'm working on another book about the farming, the people struggling as farmers in New Jersey when the industrial age was coming in. And I
Wow.
just am fascinated with that.
One of my very first interviews back in 1980, 80, 81, something like that, was and I wish I could remember the name of the author. I may still even have the book for all I know. It was called Farmland or Wasteland, and it was talking about, how we're losing X number of acres a year. This was back then, some 40 years
Still
ago.
are. We still are losing.
And I did an it did this interview, and it was rather interesting in that regard in terms of the conversation, which I vaguely remember. All I remember mostly about it was that it was a 30-minute interview. I had written down 28 questions. That's how I kind of started doing things. Now I don't write questions down. The universe asks the questions. I'm along for the ride. And I asked the 28th question in the, I'm sorry, the 14th question. There were 14 questions in the 28th minute. When the interview was over and the guest had left, I'm still sitting in the studio looking at my yellow pad and I'm going, what if this had been an hour? What the heck would you do then? And that's when I went to, shortly thereafter, I went to work for a news talk station that carried the Larry King show on Mutual Broadcasting Network. And I went to the Larry King School of Broadcasting. He never
Wow.
prepared. He did not prepare because back then he was taking phone calls. And he wanted to be, as he described it, he wanted to be as fresh as the callers. And that evolved for me into this concept of, the universe asks questions. So it's been an interesting a sojourn. You and I have, my parents too lived, my father shared with me about his growing up in the Depression. He didn't, he didn't know that it was the Depression. They always had food on the table. It may not have been in abundance, but they always had food. And it was just what he experienced. It wasn't, so each of us goes through those times. I mean, I'm so grateful for the experiences I've had growing up in Phoenix in the neighborhood that I did. It was just wonderful. And I hope that especially kids today, I don't even know what the gener I don't even know what they call the generation today, and I don't care. All I know is I wish that a lot of the kids today could experience what I did when I was growing up. It was so much fun. It was such a blast. And this so was this. This has been a wonderful conversation, Chris, because and you still have so much more that you could share because this book is not just about your hikes, but it's about your personal experience, your personal growth, which we sort of got into a little bit there. And I thank you so much for giving us this time. This has been really special.
I've loved every minute of it. Thank you. Yes, we can look at our lives through these lenses, and this is a way of looking at a life through the lens of the mountains.
I do have three final questions that I want to ask you. I ask all of my guests these questions. Before I do, I want to thank you for listening to and watching Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, where we are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I can hear it now. Christine, go take a hike. And so she did. We also encourage you to listen in at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for a special edition of Tell Me Your Story. And then again, at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. And that's 9 programs, 9 topics, 9 guests, 9 conversations. We hope you'll tune into any one or all of them. And we stream live at those times at richarddugan.com. Podcasts are on SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, Player FM, Blueberry, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, and many other locations. We are on YouTube. You know, when Chris talked about those journals that are behind her? Well, the only way you're going to know that they're there is if you go to YouTube and you watch this interview, this conversation. And we hope that you'll subscribe at the very least. Click notification so that when a new conversation is posted, you'll be notified and you can tune in and listen to that conversation. We ask, too, that if you can support the work we're doing financially, we have a PayPal account. It's there for your security as well as ours. When they ask for an address to whom you're sending, Richard@RichardDugan.com. That's Richard@RichardDugan.com. And I'll repeat this as I did during the program. We hope that you will take time during this, the Decade of Perfect Vision, to go within and listen to that still small voice. Spend some time. You can call it meditation. You can call it prayer. You can call it whatever you want. Billy Bob, George, Tree, whatever. But just spend some time doing that. And as one of my guests once said, even if it's only 60 seconds, that's all it takes. So with all of that being said, we now move to our final three questions for our very special guest, author of Going Over the Mountain, One Woman's Journey from a Follower to Solo Hiker and Back. First question, who is Christine Woodside?
Who is Christine Woodside? Well, Christine Woodside is a fellow pilgrim in the walk of life. I think of myself first, I guess, as a writer and a mother, a wife, a friend, a sister. Yeah.
What is it that gets you up in the morning?
I just want to get up and do things. I think what gets me up now is I have things I'm still itching to do, especially writing projects. My students at the University of Connecticut get me up in the morning. I love them. I think about them. I worry about them. And I, many, many, many years ago, promised my husband that I would love, honor, and cherish. And I get up to be there for him, and he gets up to be there for me.
And finally, what was your best day?
In life? My best day. Wow. There's so many best days, aren't there? I mean, I think, you know, there's sort of like a composite best day for me, mm-hmm. where I'll find myself in a beautiful place that I love, surrounded by people I love. And there aren't very many moments like that. Like you get, like I'll get to the summit of a mountain. So let's say what, as an example of the composite best day, I'm on top of Mount Lafayette in the White Mountains. My daughter Elizabeth, my daughter Annie, my husband Nat are with me, and maybe a few nieces. And the clouds are rushing by and the wind is blowing my hair. And I've got everyone I love right within earshot. That's the best day.
I love it. Well, Chris, thank you again for joining us here on the program. We'll have your website up on our podcast so people can click on that while they're listening. It is chriswoodside.com. And the book, once again, Going Over the Mountain, One Woman's Journey from Follower to Solo Hiker and Back. And we thank you for listening to and watching Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And until our next broadcast, podcast, videocast, love to all. Jeanette, I am still listening. Dad, continue to be happy because I am. To my dear friend, Smokey, I'll see you on the other side. And to my dear friend, Zorro, aho, aho.